You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Farad. Coming up, for-profit universities have been controversial, and the Obama administration took legal action against a lot of them. But a Minnesota-based for-profit school system has reopened in Wisconsin. We'll find out more in just a bit.
First, in a televised address to the nation last night, President Trump laid out his highly anticipated strategy for American involvement in Afghanistan after 16 years of an American military presence. Here is a bit of what the president had to say.
When I became president, I was given a bad and very complex hand, but I fully knew what I was getting into. Big and intricate problems. But one way or another, these problems will be solved. I'm a problem solver. And in the end, we will win.
Included in the president's plans is an increase in the amount of troops stationed in Afghanistan, although Trump wouldn't supply a number. He also declined to put a timetable on how long American troops would remain there or set deadlines for withdrawal. He also issued a strong warning to Pakistan, a strategic ally of the U.S., who Trump accuses of, quote, housing the very terrorists we're fighting, end quote.
Nahal Tusi joins us now to break down this new approach to Afghanistan. She's a foreign affairs correspondent at Politico. Nahal, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We'll get into the details in just a moment. But first, Nahal, overall, what did you make of the president's address last night?
Well, it was really striking to see him basically change his mind from years before, where he's always said, we need to get out of Afghanistan. What are we doing in Afghanistan? And now he says, well, now that I'm president and I see things from a different perspective, I've decided that we have to continue to stay there.
And do we have a sense of where that change in opinion, that change in perspective came from?
Well, basically, his advisors, especially the generals, basically came to him and said, look, if we leave and Afghanistan falls apart, we're going to be blamed. You're going to be blamed because you are now a wartime president, whether you like it or not. And I think that really, you know, frustrated the president, because he just the idea that he could be blamed for something that might fall apart like that is just a bit too much for him.
Well, and Steve Bannon, chief strategist who left the administration late last week, was very much against further involvement or even continuing the president involvement in Afghanistan. How much weight would you put to the timing of this, where Steve Bannon is out and President Trump makes this change?
You know, I think that it was probably just more of a coincidence than anything, because from what we understand, you know, over the last several weeks, there have been efforts by other people around Trump, including the vice president, to basically get him on board with this notion of staying on in Afghanistan you know, at least committing some more troops. Now, it is possible that Mr. Bannon found that his own influence was not as strong as it used to be, and that that's why he decided to leave. So it could be a coincidence. I don't know that it was necessarily a cause and effect situation.
And let's take a listen to what President Trump had to say about that change of heart.
My original instinct was to pull out. And historically, I like following my instincts. But all my life, I've heard that decisions are much different when you sit behind the desk in the Oval Office. In other words, when you're president of the United States.
Things are different when you sit in that desk at the Oval Office. And Trump is now the third American president to command American forces in Afghanistan. Based on what you heard, Nahal, how different will Trump's approach be from his predecessors?
Sort of be very similar, actually, to his predecessors, except he might go a bit more for the sticks instead of the carrots when it comes to other countries around Afghanistan, like Pakistan in particular. I mean, we do get the sense that he wants to be a bit more blunt and get other people more involved and tell Pakistan in particular that they really need to crack down on the terrorist safe havens inside their borders that, you know, are one of the reasons that the Afghan war continues and doesn't seem to have an end in sight. Now, the thing is, though, that, you know, rhetoric is one thing, but in reality is another. Whether the president's able to actually follow through with some of his promises and whether his actions are necessarily going to make a difference, that still very much remains to be seen. But it does seem like he wants to go in with at least, you know, tougher rhetoric. But again, it's, you know, this deeds, not words, are what really matter in a place like that.
Let's take a listen to what the president had to say about Pakistan.
We have been paying Pakistan billions and billions of dollars. At the same time, they are housing the very terrorists that we are fighting. But that will have to change, and that will change immediately.
Now, Nehal, Pakistan is a pretty important U.S. ally in that area, and in part for supporting the U.S. troops that are in Afghanistan for supply lines and such. What are the dangers of perhaps coming out a little too strongly against Pakistan?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, they could, you know, make moves to shut down the supply lines. They could basically unleash some of the terrorists and militant groups that are under their control in Afghanistan. We could end up seeing more violence if the Pakistanis go for this. And, you know, they could just make things a lot more difficult on a number of levels. So the U.S. has to be prepared for that. Also, you know, the whole ultimate goal is to have a peace deal, right, with the Taliban, and everybody kind of agrees that you have to have a political settlement. And frankly, like, the Taliban are not going to come to the table without Pakistan's prodding. So Pakistan might be able to play a spoiler on that level as well.
We're talking with Nehal Tusi right now. She's a foreign affairs correspondent at Politico, and she's recapping the president's address last night regarding policy moving forward with Afghanistan. And Nehal, one of the big parts of Trump's plan is to deploy more American troops to Afghanistan to continue to train Afghan forces there, but he didn't specify how many he would be sending. Are we hearing numbers coming from any other sources?
Well, we have sources telling us that, you know, the number is somewhere between 3,500 to 3,800 additional troops. They're going to be going there on, like, a training and advising type of basis, not necessarily, like, strict combat. Of course, this is separate from special forces and other units that we might have out there. And so they're going to go there, and they're going to try to help the Afghans build capacity in areas where they're not as strong as they could be. You know, for instance, probably intelligence is one, I'm guessing, and also possibly air support, that sort of thing. So, you know, the idea is to go there and to stay until there is a change in the conditions to the point where the U.S. feels like it's time to get us further out. But what also the president didn't really say is what those conditions were going to be. And that's another mystery.
Well, and President Trump was very critical in the past of President Obama giving a deadline or a date when troops were going to withdraw. And this is what he had to say on that count last night.
A core pillar of our new strategy is a shift from a time-based approach to one based on conditions. I've said it many times how counterproductive it is for the United States to announce in advance the dates we intend to begin or end military options.
Nehal, what have been the reactions that you've been hearing to that idea of we are not going to set a date, we are going to judge how things are on the ground and then proceed accordingly?
Well, frankly, that's an idea that gets a lot of support across both parties. I mean, there was a sense that that was a mistake that President Obama made, is by saying on this particular date we're going to be pulling out. But again, the question is, what sort of conditions is President Trump going to lay out there to say that, well, when these conditions are met, we're going to be leaving? And that's you know, he kind of has left it kind of open-ended. And so that's something we need to watch. And as reporters, we're certainly going to ask about it, is when will you be ready? When do you think the conditions on the ground are going to be good enough for the U.S. to leave?
Well, and I guess the other question is, what's going to be different after 16 years that hasn't happened or hasn't been able to be accomplished? What would some of those benchmarks be, possibly?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, you know, he's sending more troops, just like President Obama did. And President Obama sent actually tens of thousands of additional troops. And yet the situation really hasn't changed. And so the question then is, how is this going to be different? I mean, personally, I think a lot of it is going to come down to whether you can get Pakistan to change its behavior. But, you know, there's no end in sight for this particular war. Although, frankly, I'm one of those people who just kind of, you know, never understood the people who thought this was going to be a cakewalk and that this was going to be a simple fight in the first place.
Well, and the president did address the frustration of many Americans over how long this conflict has dragged on.
nearly 16 years after September 11th attacks, after the extraordinary sacrifice of blood and treasure, the American people are weary of war without victory.
Weary with war without victory. Nahal, what are you going to be watching for as we move forward and see this policy put into place about what victory or at least peace might look like?
Yeah, I mean, I've been really thinking about this recently, and it struck me that in a few years, we're going to have people signing up for the military who were not even born when September 11th happened. And so that's how long this war has stretched. But at the same time, you know, this is the type of struggle that in many ways, you know, lends itself to be generational, to be decades long. I mean, the U.S. still has troops in South Korea. We still have troops in Japan. So it's really important for us to have that kind of historical perspective on these sorts of things as well. And I guess I'm just going to be watching to see what sort of actions Mr. Trump is going to be putting behind his words. And that to me is really, really key. And we're just going to have to keep watching it. I have a feeling that, you know, years and years from now, I'm still going to be talking about this war.
Nahal, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Nahal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent at Politico. She joined us to talk about the president's strategy for American involvement in Afghanistan.
Coming up, we'll learn about a for-profit university system with Minnesota roots that's gained traction in Wisconsin under the Trump administration. Stay with us here on Central Time.
The Minnesota-based for-profit Globe University has faced a number of legal challenges in its home state. Globe University had a number of campuses in several states, including 11 in Wisconsin. Attorneys in Minnesota argued that Globe University engaged in fraudulent claims about its courses, and the Obama administration stopped providing federal funding to the system at the end of 2016.
That led Globe to announce the closure of its Wisconsin campuses, but the for-profit group has gained a new foothold in Wisconsin thanks in part to the Trump administration, which disagreed with some of the legal arguments that attorneys in Minnesota had made.
Paul Fain is an editor for Inside Higher Ed and has been covering this story. Paul, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
What exactly led to the closing of Globe University?
So the Minnesota Attorney General pursued Globe and its sister institution, the Minnesota School of Business, over a criminal justice program that didn't properly prepare police officers. The program basically didn't give them the requirements they needed to get the job. So at that point, the court sided with the Attorney General and ruled that that was a fraudulent program. And the state of Minnesota yanked its license to operate there. And the federal government followed up shortly thereafter. This was in December under President Obama, amid a broader crackdown on for-profit colleges, where they pulled federal aid eligibility to Globe and the Minnesota School of Business in both states.
And so, as we said, this is a for-profit university. It is owned by a family. Tell us about that family and their holdings.
Yes. So this is a Terry Myers family. They owned Globe and the Minnesota School of Business, as well as Broadview University. And it's a complicated ownership structure, but it's safe to say that Terry Meyer has been a primary owner for a long time, going back to the 70s. But yes, this school has actually been in your state, Wisconsin, for far longer than that, and has generally had a pretty good history of serving folks, and most recently did a lot with veterinary technologists and medical assistants. So it had been operating there for quite some time.
And so why has Broadview University now gained a foothold after Globe was shut down?
So this is where it gets very complicated, and I think pretty interesting. The for-profit college issue has gotten very partisan, and the Obama administration and Democrats in Congress pushed a pretty broad crackdown, and there was a wave of closures, much of that driven by, frankly, more students, not students not really going to for-profits anymore. But also some of that was due to the regulatory crackdown and the bad PR that came with that. So when the department shut down, essentially shut down Broadview and Globe, that a month later, there was a new administration and some of a rollback on the regulations began. The Trump administration has begun deregulating to some extent rules governing for-profits. And what they did, Broadview came in and got an agreement to kind of teach out, to wind down the Globe campuses, including four in Wisconsin. And like I mentioned, Broadview has a common owner that is Jerry Meyer's family. They had asked to purchase those campuses and continue operating them. And the state agency in Wisconsin approved that. The Obama administration did not, out of concerns of the common owner, essentially saying, well, you know, you have the same owner, so you can't keep operating. The Trump administration disagreed, agreed with the state agency in Wisconsin that approved the sale to Broadview and allowed that sale to go forward. So Broadview will assume operation of those campuses going forward.
We're talking with Paul Fain right now. He's an editor for Inside Higher Ed, and we're talking about Globe University and now Broadview University. And Paul, so Globe was owned by the Meyer family. They basically, that was shut down. They are now opening Broadview University, buying up Globe properties, but it's kind of from one pocket to another in the same family. Is this something that's still going to run afoul of Minnesota, if not the feds?
Well, they're done in Minnesota. Minnesota's attorney general is still pursuing that case. Recently, the Supreme Court there ruled that some of the loans, all of the loans that they issued to students recently, many loans. I think 6,000 students were issued illegally. They weren't properly licensed. They had up to an 18% interest rate, and I believe that applies to some former Globe students in Wisconsin, and the attorney general there is seeking to have those loans forgiven and restitution for students. So they still have some problems in that state. In Wisconsin, Broadview has those campuses now, and it's been a relatively, I guess you could say, seamless transition in that they were winding down Globe campuses, and now they're going to keep running them. So that will move forward. And I should say that one really interesting piece of this is, again, the state agency in Wisconsin approved of this, and I would not say in any way that they are stooges for the for-profits. They've been, I would say, the most kind of high-profile, aggressive state agency in cracking down on for-profits in your state. So really kind of an interesting cast of characters here.
And that's the Wisconsin Educational Approval Board, I believe.
Correct, yes. A small agency, I think it's four or five employees, headed by David Dees. And to complicate this plot even further, the Educational Approval Board has been under fire for years from Governor Scott Walker, in part for the reputation they do have of being tough on for-profits. And it looks like, as part of the budget, which, is, tell me if I'm wrong, hasn't been approved yet in your state?
Correct.
They will be moved to another agency. The executive director will lose his job, and the independent board that oversees that agency will be disbanded. So you can make a strong case that they'll be weakened going forward. So, again, this is, on the national level, a state agency that's been quite aggressive. In the wake of a bunch of shutdowns of big for-profits in Milwaukee, they moved aggressively to do some things that even went a little further than the Obama administration did. And, you know, David Dees made the case to me that Globe was providing a good service in the state, and that the kind of kill shot, the putting them out of business, wasn't warranted in Wisconsin.
You talked about specifically complaints against Globe University that led to lawsuits and also federal regulation. We talked to Tressie McMillan about her book Lower Ed, about what she saw as some of the unscrupulous recruiting efforts by for-profit universities. What would you add to those parts that address why for-profit universities as a whole have been fairly controversial?
Sure. Well, that is a tough issue. There are many folks out there who are opposed to for-profit higher education generally, feel like the profit seeking shouldn't be part of higher education. That's a tough argument, though. For many, though, I would say a lot of higher education deals with for-profit companies. I mean, colleges everywhere have outsourced their dining halls to companies, so it gets murky. You know, higher education is a big business, and as a society, the courts, you know, higher education writ large has not said for-profits equal bad, for sure. But there are some high-profile closures. ITT and Corinthian Colleges in particular really, I'd say, turned a tide in that it became hard to operate as a for-profit from a regulatory and business standpoint. And part of the problem is a lot of for-profits will tell you this. The jobs that they train people for often are lower income, and you know the student results, the kind of ability to pay off their loans, ability to get good jobs, are harder for a lot of for-profit students. So it becomes a question of who is training your medical assistants, and are they doing a good enough job, and when should regulators step in?
And what is the next step in both the current litigation that's going on in Minnesota and general oversight in Wisconsin of universities that are for-profit like Broadview?
Good question. I think Minnesota has been very aggressive, and not just in this case. I think it's safe to say that Globe and the Meyer family won't be going back there. A lot of folks in Minnesota would say that's a good thing, but some might say that those institutions will be missed. That depends on who you ask. There are some consumer advocates and experts here in Washington who are disappointed by the decision for Globe to continue operating in Wisconsin, in part because of allegations that they also misled students in the state, particularly about the transferability of their credits. It's a complicated issue, but I think Globe, or I should say Broadview, will continue to operate, and you know they're going to have to kind of bring the university back. So that's unclear if they'll be able to do it. As far as the approval board that oversees for-profits. Some for-profit advocates have told me, well, because of all the closures in the state, maybe you don't need an independent agency. But we looked at the numbers, and 29 for-profits have closed in Wisconsin, but there are still more than 200 there. So, it wasn't my sense that this approval board had a lot of time on their hands. I'd actually was in their office a few years back, and it seemed like they were pretty busy, and I think they'll continue to be busy. And for some folks, if they're weakened, that's not a good thing.
Well, Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.
Paul Fain is an editor for Inside Higher Ed. He joined us to talk about Globe University, which had closed in Wisconsin, but is now coming back under a new name.
Coming up, behind the ongoing string of controversies, our guest says the Trump administration has made a lot of significant changes in regulations and enforcement. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time.
Now, by some measures, the Trump administration has had a bad start in its first 7 months. Approval ratings are at historic lows, healthcare legislation stalled, and other legislative battles are still on the sideline. Add to that high-profile staff turnover, a running tally of controversial statements by the president, and the ongoing Russia investigations.
Our next guest says that those are all real problems for the president and his supporters, but in lower-profile ways, the president and his team have made a lot of changes in courts, regulations, and enforcement that could make a lasting difference.
David A. Graham is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers U.S. politics and global news. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you laid out a bunch of specific accomplishments of the Trump administration. Before we get into the specifics, though, there's been a lot of focus, of course, on the high-profile controversies and the tweets, the legislative difficulties. Do we miss a big part of the story if that's all we focus on?
I think we do. I mean, you can very easily get either lulled into a sense of complacency or lulled into despair, perhaps, by imagining that nothing is going on and that the Trump administration is totally stagnated. And I think that misses some consequential changes going on in the country because of federal government policies.
Right. There's a lot a president can do without Congress being on board. And the Trump administration looks like is exercising some of that power.
That's right. What we see is a lot of action going on in the executive branch in areas that, the heads of departments and agencies can do on their own without really involvement from Congress. And for that matter, without a lot of involvement from the White House itself.
Let's get into some specific areas here. Environmental regulation is one you focus on. There's a lot going on there. Can you talk about some of the things we're seeing?
Sure. I mean, it's a whole range of things, and it runs across departments. You know, the most high-profile thing is probably Trump's decision to pull out of the Paris Climate Accord. But what's gotten less attention are the sort of policies that go behind that. So that includes the EPA working to roll back the Obama-era Clean Power Plan. That involves rewriting the Waters of the U.S. rule, which the Obama administration planned to expand to cover streams and rivers and smaller bodies of waters than it had previously. It involves, for example, opening up public lands potentially to fracking and to coal mining. That involves trying to roll back regulations on things like methane, although courts have sometimes intervened. So there's a long list of these places where regulations have been cut or reversed or rewritten.
Now, these are things, if one administration does something, the next one can undo it, which is we're seeing a lot of now with Obama-era regulations being changed. But these are things that in the course of 4 or 8 years or however long there's a Republican administration, these are things that can have long-term consequences, right?
That's right. Exactly. They do have long-term consequences, and some of them are more permanent than others. You know, it is relatively easy, for example, to change the regulations on, I mean, relatively easy. None of these things are easy. Government is so hard, but to change regulations on the way business works, you know, in the financial sector. But these environmental regulations are, you know, if you look at the timing, a lot of these things are at a pivotal moment. What the U.S. carbon emissions are like in 4 years says a lot about where the globe will be in 4 years. So these are very consequential changes.
Talking to David Graham about accomplishments, often sort of behind the scenes, behind the controversies in the Trump administration, whether you're glad of the changes or not. Now let's turn to another area you write about, law enforcement. Even as the president has criticized his attorney general, that attorney general has been able to make some significant changes.
Right. And I think that might be one reason you see Jeff Sessions hanging around. Even as he's getting this flack from the Oval Office, he's able to do a lot of things that he's wanted to do for a long time. So that basically that involves sort of tough on crime policies, reinstituting or offering guidance suggesting that prosecutors pursue strong sentences for low-level drug offenders, which is something the Obama Justice Department discouraged, making it easier for police to seize assets, which is basically when somebody is suspected of a crime but not necessarily charged. Police can seize, for example, if they have cash on their person, they can just take that. So you've got a bunch of these policies where Sessions is rolling back what the Obama administration did, and for that matter, bucking a trend in both parties toward sort of fewer tough on crime policies and a softer war on drugs.
Yeah, you wrote in another piece that much of what the president has done and accomplished is what Republicans in general want. But on this issue of criminal justice, as you say, this may be running afoul of some in his own party.
That's right. I mean, I don't think it's an accident that these things that are getting done are generally sort of core Republican Party goals, things that any Republican president would have done. And in fact, not things Trump talked about. But justice is one that is an outlier. Jeff Sessions was to the right of the Republican Party on a lot of justice issues, or rather he was maybe 10 to 15 years behind where the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, for that matter, used to be. And so you have him bucking what even many Republican senators and governors have asked for in terms of, you know, focusing more on rehabilitation and not going for the strongest sentences and, you know, looking a little bit over low-level offenses on matters.
And on a related note, we've seen a change in the Justice Department's attitude toward local police departments, or the Obama administration had been doing more reviews, more consent decrees. It seems like a Jeff Sessions Department of Justice not so interested in that kind of thing.
That's right. And you know, the things that we see Sessions doing, so that's rolling back the emphasis on overseeing police departments, trying to back out of agreements that already exist with police departments to sort of oversee reforms. These are not things that Trump spoke about specifically during the campaign, but they're directly in line. You know, he would talk a lot about supporting police and the sort of Blue Lives Matter idea. So you didn't hear him saying, I'm going to go out and I'm going to tear up consent decrees with cities. This just isn't the sort of language Trump uses. But the principle is exactly what Sessions is carrying out at the Justice Department.
On a similar note, I mean, of course, the border wall was one of the president's biggest campaigning points. He's going to build that wall. We don't have the wall. We only have a little bit of the funding for it. But you write that there have been significant changes in the number of people coming across our southern border.
Yeah, you know, it's a testament perhaps to the power of rhetoric. That if you tell people they're not welcome and you make that very clear, people are less likely to come. Now, the pace of crossings of the border has been on a decline. That started in the Obama administration, but it's continued under Trump and in some cases dropped more quickly. So you do see Trump managing to depress the level of border crossing even without having to actually start erecting the wall.
But does the president get to call that a win if he doesn't get the wall or something like a wall on the southern border?
I don't think he does. I mean, I think that's the real political pickle here. These are things that, as I say, tend to be they tend to appeal to the traditional Republican dogma and to the sort of business base of the Republican Party. What they don't necessarily appeal to is the coalition that Trump brought into the GOP, people who might not have voted Republican before or might not have voted consistently. What, you know, these are people who wanted to see a wall, and they want, you know, there are all these things that Trump promised, and Trump is not following through on them. There's no wall. There's no Obamacare repeal and so on. And I think that causes a political problem for him now and potentially in 2020 as well.
Another piece of this that you point to that I think has been most under the radar is what's happening in court appointments. Now, of course, we have a new Supreme Court justice. That was a big deal, I think, in how a lot of people voted in the presidential election. But the Supreme Court is not the only court in the land. Can you talk about what's going on with often lifetime appointments to federal courts?
Sure. I mean, you know, most of the court appointments that go on in a presidential term are obviously not on the Supreme Court. They're at the lower levels, so at the both the district and circuit courts, federal courts. And I haven't checked for a few days. I believe Trump has five confirmed judges in those lower courts and 30 or so nominations waiting. So that's 35 judges already at this early stage in the presidency. They will have lifetime appointments. They tend to be young, and they tend to be conservative. And again, these are people who would be on the list for many Republican presidents, but they have the potential to reshape precedent and the law for decades to come, and potentially to someday advance to the Supreme Court as well.
And this is something that I think we don't talk about all that often on this show. I don't see that much in the media. It's not a high-profile point of political debate. Is this something that people should be paying more attention to?
Well, I think a lot of these things are. I mean, they're really consequential. And you know, I think I am as much to blame as anyone else. The things that the White House is doing are flashy, and they're legitimately controversial. I mean, we talk about these Trump controversies, and they're not, you know, they're not insignificant. I don't think we should be ignoring them. When people say they're a distraction, I tend to doubt that because they are often not good for the president. But it doesn't mean these things aren't happening and they don't matter. And I think they matter for the country, and they also matter from a political perspective.
Now, you wrote about these accomplishments of the Trump administration in one piece. You've also written lately that, in a certain sense, the president is already a lame duck in his first year in office. What did you mean by that?
Well, you think about the things that a lame duck president does. He starts focusing on things that he can do for the executive branch. He loses the ability to effectively lobby Congress. And, you know, he starts turning inward. His aides start to snipe at each other. They start leaving the administration. You see all these things that tend to happen in the last, 7 months of a presidential term rather than in the first 7 months. And I think the things we're talking about, these accomplishments, fit with that. You know, these are administrative changes. They're regulatory changes. And although they are important, they're not things that require a lot of effort or buy-in from the administration. They're things that the president does sort of nibbling around the edges.
We're talking with David Graham, staff writer for The Atlantic, looking at the accomplishments of the Trump administration so far. A lot, he says, changing. A lot of things with long-term consequences in spite of all the high-profile controversies.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you glad or worried that the Trump administration is using executive authority to dial back environmental and other regulations? Do you think there's been too much focus on the tweets and controversies and not enough on what's going on in federal departments? Do you see the Trump administration as a success, a failure, or somewhere in between? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing our conversation with David Graham from The Atlantic, looking at the Trump administration and a lot of accomplishments behind the scenes when it comes to court appointments, regulations changes, and enforcement of federal rules.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see the Trump administration getting a lot done, especially in those lower profile kind of ways? If so, do you see that as good news or bad news? If you voted for the president president? Are things going as you'd hoped if you voted against him? Are things going as you had feared? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. David, we've talked a lot about the things the president has done with executive actions, but for a lot of the things that he and the Republicans had hoped to get done, he can't do it without Congress. Healthcare, tax reform, the wall, a lot of other stuff. Do you see any signs, given what we've seen so far, that the White House and Republicans in Congress can get together on things like that?
Well, we have a couple crucial things coming up in the next month. We've got a debt ceiling increase and a spending bill, and I think that will be two interesting moments. If they fail to work together, well, one thing, the country will default, which could be catastrophic. So that will tell us something. If they work together, perhaps that will start to build some sort of trust and that the two sides can kind of work forward on their other priorities. But, you know, there are these deep ideological fissures that are going on. This is not just a question of they know what they want to do and they have disagreements about how to get there. They have deep disagreements about where they want to go. And the president has not shown really the interest or the attention span or the ability to effectively lobby members of Congress on the matters he cares about.
I want to go to our callers at 800-642-1234. Kelly joins us in Milwaukee. Kelly, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I just wanted to express my sadness around a lot of the rollbacks for environmental policy. I've traveled in South America spreading environmental messages. I've lived, you know, in Colorado and the Pacific Northwest and seen a lot of the firsthand effects of drought and forest fires and, you know, things that are just unprecedented, and I have two young children, and I just can't fathom the lack of concern and consciousness around that, and just feel like it's a real pity. And I think what I'm seeing with the state of Wisconsin, I lived in Wisconsin about 15 years ago, and coming back and seeing what feels like a lot of steps backwards and rollback of policy just feels really disheartening.
Kelly, thanks for the call. David, I think there are a lot of people out there, like Kelly, worried about the environment. Are there enough people that that turn it into enough of a political issue that, you know, you might see a difference in an election, say, like in 2018?
Well, that's always been that's recently been a big challenge for the environmental movement. A lot of people do care about these things, but it is not always the top priority that people have, and it's hard to build a coalition to sort of swing elections that way. It tends to take real catastrophes to get people moving, and so that remains to be seen. It also doesn't help that many of these moves are things that are kind of quiet under the radar. You don't notice fracking on public lands until it's already started, and you visit a national forest and you see it. The one saving grace for environmentalists, I think, is the courts. You've seen Scott Pruitt's EPA trying to delay rules and trying to shift things, and on a couple occasions, the courts have smacked them down. Once they tried to loosen methane rules, and the court said they didn't have the authority to do that. In another case, they announced plans to delay a rule on ozone emissions. And after a great deal of pressure, including some lawsuits, the EPA reversed course and announced they wouldn't do that delay, which seemed like a case of them being pushed back either by public outcry or by the legal threat, or maybe a combination of both.
Kelly, thanks for that call. Go next to Jim in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Hi. You know, Trump will accomplish those things that the Republican economic establishment want, which is massive corporate tax breaks and anything that will economically or environmentally aid them and probably be at the cost of consumers. The question I have for your guest is whether he agrees with me that Justice Kennedy will be the swing vote on the Wisconsin election law case coming to the U.S. Supreme, and does he think he will be there for the vote? I'll take my answer off the air.
Jim, thanks for the call. A lot there. First of all, on the economy, Jim saying the president might not do the economic nationalist things that he'd promised in the campaign, might not be able to. The sort of things that Steve Bannon might have been advocating for. He'll only accomplish things that Republicans in Congress already wanted to do.
I think he's got a great point. I mean, you know, Trump and his allies talk about the deep state stopping him. But what's really stopping him is the Republican Party in Congress. And that's where many of his top priorities are sort of going to die. You mentioned Steve Bannon, and I think it's interesting. Bannon said, I believe back in February, that, that one thing Trump was going to do was to go in and, quote, dismantle the administrative state, close quotes. And instead what we see is the administrative state is the place where Trump is getting almost all of the things he's getting done, done, and Steve Bannon is, of course, gone. I'm going to take a pass on predictions on the Supreme Court. I've made too many bad predictions over the last 18 months or so, and I don't want to add one to my list.
All right. Well, don't worry. We will be covering that definitely as it goes through the Supreme Court. We are talking to David Graham from The Atlantic right now, looking at President Trump's accomplishments so far in the White House. He says a lot of things with long-term implications when it comes to regulation, to enforcement, to courts, even under the radar in many cases, given the high-profile controversies. Back to your calls now, Jake on the line in Milwaukee. Jake, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Jake?
I just want to bring up, usually when things start going bad for a president, they start some form of military action, and we're seeing that case of history repeating itself right now.
Jake, thanks for the call. And that is something that the president has had control over, David. More troop levels in Afghanistan, though nowhere near as much as under the Obama administration, but also increases in bombing raids and other strikes in other countries around the world.
Jake is totally right. That is an old standby for a president in trouble. I think it creates an interesting dilemma for Trump, and I'm curious to see how it plays out. Because while rallying around a war is often a good move for a president, I think Trump has a couple things that undercut him. One is his tendency to make the worst out of a crisis and make things worse for himself. Another is the fact that he ran promising to draw down the wars. And so while he might gain some boost in the sort of patriotism index initially, he also is going against his base. The third thing is that the Afghanistan war at this point is such a long-running thing that it you know, I'm not sure it has the kind of political juice. People don't get excited about it. They are fatigued about it, which is, of course, why Trump also felt fatigued all those months ago when he was running against it during the election.
Jake, thanks. Troy joins us next from Muskego. Troy, hi.
Hello. I just want to say that it turns my stomach for being someone who's pro-labor. I think people are going to realize that all these things that are going on, especially the president's bragging about Foxconn and how that's set up in Wisconsin. But people don't realize this is a non-union, $12 an hour job type situation. And what saddens me is that long after this president's done, there's going to be a hard fight for people to fight for wages and the middle class and benefits again. This president is he's empowering capitalism and he's oppressing workers.
Troy, thanks for the call. Is there a big difference on labor issues from a President Trump from a president, say, George W. Bush?
Well, I think we're a little bit early to get a good sense of what we'll have in terms of sort of, you know, NLRB decisions. But certainly the, you know, things like Foxconn or like the fight over the carrier plant in Indiana, what you see is Trump sort of bullying companies to stay in the U.S., which is very much out of keeping with what previous Republican presidents did. And then also, but he's essentially buying these jobs at great cost and tax credits. He and partners are buying these jobs at a great cost. So it's adding to deficits and adding to spending. That's something that a lot of Republicans have looked askance at, and we'll see whether that's really a sustainable strategy.
Troy, thanks for the call. David, I mean, what would it take to turn things around for the Trump administration and get those big ticket items through Congress briefly as we wrap up?
I mean, I think he's got to learn how to work with Congress a little bit better, and that's something he hasn't shown a lot of interest for in so far. And the other question, you know, is there a major crisis? And if so, is Trump able to learn to make the best out of it rather than, as we've seen in Charlottesville, making it really into a worse problem for himself?
David, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
I've been talking to David Graham, staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers U.S. politics and global news.